Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take a look at a brand new to us case, the 1981 murder of schoolteacher Olivia Christian. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, leave a review, like, and follow the show, and share it on social media. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows and exclusive content, just as the first two Patreon members, Chandel and Anthony, did many, many months ago, and they have been joined by a slew of others who I try and give shout-outs to: Samantha, Debbie, Robert, Ruben, Jason. All of them came on board, so I hope you guys will follow suit and do the same. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. If you're at work, I hope this helps you get through the day. I have my coffee. I have my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. This week, we are taking a look at a new case, that of the 1981 murder of Olivia Dare Christian in Hampton, Virginia, on September 4th, 1981. Olivia was a 32-year-old schoolteacher who lived in the Ivy Home Apartments with her cat. Olivia was seen as a good neighbor and really something of a pillar of her community that made a difference in the lives of those who knew her. She was a dedicated Christian who had a steady boyfriend and a very close-knit family. What set Olivia apart from many others in her profession was that Olivia didn't just look after the education of the students in her class at Captain John Smith Elementary School. Everyone in the Ivy League apartments knew she had an open door policy so that any student in this predominantly African American housing complex was free to come and get help with their schooling from Olivia. Now, on this day, September 4th, 1981, it was the Friday right before Labor Day. Olivia had plans to complete a week of in-service training at Captain John Smith School before spending her weekend with friends, family, church, as well as volunteering at a crisis hotline and attending a movie date with her boyfriend. On this Friday morning, as with most mornings, Olivia arose, made her breakfast, which consisted of eggs and toast, and then took her cat for a quick walk around the complex so that the cat could do its business before heading back into her apartment. Now, one thing Olivia was known to do was to leave her door slightly ajar when she left her apartment so that she could go out and in without having to take her keys with her. And shortly after going back into her apartment, somewhere between 7 and 8 o'clock, residents would later tell police that they heard screams coming from Olivia's apartment. And it should be noted that despite hearing this, no one made any attempts to inquire as to what was going on, whether everything was all right with Olivia. None of that took place. As the day progresses, Olivia's friends began to become concerned as she had not turned up for her in-service training. And by 2 o'clock, one of her fellow teachers and Brian had become concerned enough with Olivia's disappearance that she began asking around the school to find out if anyone had seen Olivia. After speaking to a few of the other teachers, as well as the principal of the school, Anne learned that no one had heard from Olivia that day. She ends up finishing up her work and going home to her apartment, at which point Anne makes a phone call to Olivia's apartment that goes unanswered. Not long after this, Anne's husband comes home and she discusses with her fears that Olivia is not answering the phone, and the two of them decide that it would be best if they contact Olivia's boyfriend, an army captain by the name of John Kelly, who the two of them had introduced Olivia to somewhere around a year earlier. After speaking to John and learning that he had not heard from Olivia as he had been at work all day, Anne hangs up and at roughly 4:30 p.m. decides it would be prudent if she contacted Olivia's parents, Thomas and Peggy Christian. Now, the two parents are retired. They live a short distance from their daughter, and upon calling them, Anne informs Thomas that they have not heard anything from Olivia all day long. She's concerned. Thomas agrees to find out what's going on with his daughter. And after hanging up the phone with Anne, Thomas places a call to Olivia's apartment. And just as her fellow school teacher had, Thomas gets no reply, at which point he decides that it's best if he drives over there and finds out exactly what is going on. At roughly 5 p.m., Thomas Christian arrives at the Ivy Home apartment complex, pulls into a parking spot, and sees his daughter's car sitting in its normal parking slot. Now, describing the Ivy Home apartment complex briefly, it's a series of buildings, each building containing 4 apartments, 2 downstairs, 2 upstairs, and Olivia lives in apartment 1F, which is the first apartment in building F. Going inside the interior corridor of the building, Thomas Christian knocks on Olivia's door a number of times and receives no answer, at which point Thomas decides to enter Olivia's apartment. Using a key his daughter had given him, Thomas enters the apartment, calls out to his daughter a number of times, receives no response, and begins looking around. Now, those who knew Olivia said that she was a fastidious housekeeper, so it was alarming when her father noticed that the apartment seemed to be in disarray, as there was a broken vase on the living room floor, and it appeared as though someone had rummaged through the kitchen drawers. He was able to see all of this from standing in the front door. Then he noticed that Olivia's meal was left sitting, partially eaten, on the kitchen table. This furthered the sense of dread that Mr. Christian was feeling as he made his way further back into the apartment. Mr. Christian would later tell police that his sense of unease continued to grow as he made his way inside. He saw more signs that something was amiss. The kitchen and the blender was broken. There were pictures hanging askew on the wall. And it became fairly apparent that some form of a struggle had taken place inside of Olivia's apartment. Now, according to Thomas, when he entered Olivia's bedroom, it was like the world suddenly slowed down. His daughter's lying on the ground, face down in a pool of blood. Her face is battered beyond recognition. One of her breasts is exposed. And it was hard for him to process what it was exactly that he was seeing. So Thomas ends up going over to Olivia and pulling her towards him, trying to see if she is all right. After a few moments, though, it becomes apparent that, unfortunately, his daughter is deceased. Her skin is cold to the touch. Her eyes are stuck open with a glassy look in them. Thomas eventually places her back on the floor, and in his own words again, in a daze, he stumbles over to the rotary phone in Olivia's bedroom and calls 911. As in any murder investigation, the police arrive, they secure the scene. The first thing they're going to do is to try and figure out A, if anyone saw anything, and B, what the motive could be for this crime. Now, obviously, the father is on scene. He is the first person that police are going to question, and it becomes readily apparent due to Thomas's demeanor that he has nothing whatsoever to do with his daughter's murder. Once they bring Thomas back to his house where his wife is at, again, it's apparent to officers that neither of the Christians have anything to do with their daughter's murder. They learn that Olivia had no known enemies, was really a pillar of the community, that she has a boyfriend and an older brother. Officers question the older brother, and again, it's apparent that there is no connection between any of Olivia's family members and her murder. They do learn, however, that individuals saw a number of unknown cars at the apartment complex on the day Olivia died, and they get a number of different descriptions from various people living inside of the apartment complex. This is called canvassing, where officers will go around and question everyone living in an area in order to find out if anything out of the ordinary took place. Now, suspicion falls initially on Olivia's neighbor, as an African-American woman. They thought that maybe something had been going on between Olivia and this neighbor's boyfriend, but other than the fact that the woman is somewhat brash, they quickly rule this neighbor out as well. The police do learn, however, that a number of people in the Ivy Home Apartments complex heard a woman screaming that morning. Some of them thought it was a domestic disturbance. Others didn't want to think anything about it. One woman stated that she was running out to her car at the time, desperate to get to work, and really couldn't be bothered with it, although she did believe it was coming from Olivia's apartment. So the officers go through all of this, the crime scene investigation, looking for fingerprints, removal of the body, all of the things that we have come to expect during a crime scene investigation. The one thing that they walked away with was that Olivia Christian had put up one hell of a fight although they could not at this point determine whether Olivia had walked in on a robbery in progress or had been targeted by the killer for some other reason, such as a sexual motive. And they still have to talk with her boyfriend, who, if you'll recall, is the captain in the U.S. Army. Other information that they learned is that Olivia always kept the blinds to her apartment open for her cat to be able to see outside, and that she would often walk her cat around the complex, leaving her front door slightly ajar so that she would not have to return and retrieve her keys. Another resident was said to have had frequent male visitors, and some of the residents of the Ivy Home Apartments thought that maybe one of these men had shown up and mistakenly gone to Olivia's apartment, and Olivia had died as a result of this, although police were unable to prove this as fact. From the maintenance man at the complex, they learned that on Thursday, which was the day before, he had observed a white male in what he described as a green Plymouth with North Carolina plates, a quote-unquote businessman's car, which was parked directly in front of Olivia's apartment. And he had observed the man between 4:30 and 5:30 p.m. staring. This maintenance man also stated that he had approached this man, and the man had begun questioning him about the resident of the apartment, asking if the, quote, thin white lady lived there, what time she left for work, what time she came back from work. And again, this is all according to the maintenance man. He said that the man was sitting in his car when he left that evening at roughly 6 p.m. The man was described as being 40 to 45 years old, roughly 5 foot 8 inches tall, heavy set build with a pot belly, a round face, short cropped hair, combed neat. He was also said to have worn a mustache that was neatly trimmed, and much like his hair, was brown in color, along with black glasses, black slacks, a white button-up shirt, black tie, and green sport coat. The man also stated that this individual seemed out of place, was a little bit nervous and fidgety. So now this is a road that the investigators are going to have to go down. Remember, this is 1981. States did not have interlocking computer systems at this point, so tracking this particular individual down is going to be something of a task. The maintenance man further stated that he believed the car was either a Plymouth Volare or Duster, and he put the year at either 1977 or 1978. Now, armed with this information, police are going to put out a BOLO, which is a be on the lookout for this vehicle and its driver, in an attempt to identify who this mysterious individual was that had been showing so much interest in Olivia's apartments. A name that kept coming up during this initial stage of the investigation when they're canvassing in the neighborhood was Michael, who was said to be an African-American man in his mid to late 30s. Now, many people said he had a questionable reputation around the apartments and was believed to be a peeping Tom. Again, this is someone that the police are going to have to try. At this point, officers leave the apartment complex. This is in the early evening hours, and head back to headquarters so that they can reconvene
compare notes and decide which particular thread that they have gotten from their canvas of the neighborhood is the most likely suspect for them to pursue. And keep in mind, they still have not yet talked to Olivia's boyfriend. When the main detectives on the case get back to the police department and are going over their notes, a phone call comes in at roughly 11:30 p.m. from a woman who lives in the apartments named Valerie Purcell. Valerie's apartment building is across the parking lot from Olivia's. In fact, she can look from her apartment into Olivia's, and she states that her daughter had seen something earlier that day, which very well could be of importance to the investigation. So officers return to the Ivy Home apartment complex and go to apartment F2, where Anita is at. She informs them that she's been gone all day and had just gotten home and seen the note that was left on her door by officers earlier in the evening, and that another neighbor had informed her what had happened. Now, Valerie goes on to state that her daughter had seen something that day, and in fact believes she may have seen the man responsible for Olivia's murder. Olivia states that at roughly 6:10 that morning, she was looking out the apartment window to watch her mother go get in her car and head off to work, and that by 6:30 she was making pancakes for her younger siblings when she glanced out the window and saw a car drive into the parking lot. The car drove all the way down the length of the parking lot to the far end before the driver, who is described as an African-American man, backed into a parking spot and sat there. When questioned about the type of car, Anita stated that while she was not very good on make and models of vehicles, she thought it might have been an old Chrysler. Anita said that after the man sat there for a while, he got out of his vehicle and began walking around the complex. Officers asked her for a description of the man. She described him again as African American with an average build, roughly 6 foot tall, sporting a mustache and wearing a blank navy blue ball cap on top of his head. Anita stated that the man walked past Olivia's apartment before coming back to it and peering through the window and walking away again before eventually returning to look into the window again, at which point he walked up to the doorway that led into the apartment building proper, specifically the hallway that separated the two downstairs apartments. Nita said that the man opened the door, placed 1 foot inside, and appeared to be looking around. She noticed that the man leaned more towards Olivia's apartment door than the other, and it seemed to her that he was listening, and after a few moments, the man slipped inside the building, closing the outside door behind him. Officers asked Anita if she saw either the man or Olivia after this, and she stated that at this point she had to go back to fixing breakfast for her siblings, but that she returned to the window on a number of occasions, curious to see if the man would make another appearance, and that eventually, as Anita went to the window to look out, the man was driving away from his parking spot, and the two of them locked eyes. Officers asked Anita if she believed she could pick the man from a police lineup, and she confirmed that this was the case, stating that he had, quote-unquote, the eyes of a monster. So, Now, officers have this piece of information, although they are still no closer to solving Olivia Christian's murder. They do, however, have a number of leads that they are going to have to track down. While officers are getting this statement, another group of detectives is eventually able to make contact with Olivia's boyfriend. Now, this is the army captain by the name of John Kelly. And they learn from Kelly that he had been at work all day and had been at a model building club that evening. When asked if it was unusual for him to not hear from Olivia, you know, on a fairly consistent basis, he confirmed that it was in fact not unusual for them to not talk every day, although he did state that he was in love with her. Officers initially refused to give Kelly any information as they're trying to discern whether or not he could have been responsible for Olivia. At the police station, when John Kelly is interviewed, he's initially told only that Olivia has died. And the officer conducting this interview noted that his reaction was one of absolute shock and that he kept coming back to the question of what had happened, which officers, again, would not initially tell him. Kelly stated that the last time he had seen Olivia was that Monday, which was August 31st, when she had come over to his townhouse to have dinner, bringing with her a kitten that she had found and nursed back to health, and that the two of them had watched a movie on his VCR before Olivia left at roughly 10:30 p.m., and that the last time he had seen her prior to that was the prior weekend when they had gone camping with a group of friends in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Kelly told officers that Olivia was not the type of person that you could get mad at, and that he had started his day at 5:30 by doing exercises before heading into work, at which point Olivia's co-worker, Ann Bryan, had contacted him wondering where Olivia was. And Kelly stated that this was the first time he had learned that Olivia had not gone to work that day. Pressed as to why he himself did not follow up on Olivia's whereabouts, Kelly told the officer that as Anne stated she was going to call her parents, he let the matter lie as the two of them had their own separate lives, and he really didn't think that much of the fact that Olivia had not been at work. Officers then get a consent form from John Kelly to search both his vehicle as well as his townhouse, as well as fingerprints from him. Again, Kelly asks the officers how Olivia died, and they will not give him an answer. John Kelly leaves the police department at 1 a.m. and heads back to his home with no further knowledge as to what has happened to his girl. At this point in the investigation, less than 24 hours in, officers are not able to rule out John Kelly as a viable suspect. The officers spend the next few hours going over everything that they know. Some of the officers feel that Olivia had known her assailant well. Other officers believe that this was a random attack perpetrated by an individual unknown to both Olivia and the police. There's also discussion of the individual that Anita had seen, with some of the officers believing that she may have been confused. You have to remember, Anita is not an adult. She is in her early to mid-teens. And some of the officers think that she may have seen the car that the caretaker had described as being driven by a white man and confused it with a different vehicle. They also put forth the idea that Anita may, in fact, have seen Michael. However, it should be pointed out that Michael, who, if you'll recall, was an African-American man, was said to have a full beard. So this, none of this is fitting together so far as they can see at this point in the other ideas posited at this point in time include a former boyfriend and the idea that Olivia may have spurned someone who had feelings for her at some point, which may have led an individual to go and attack her. Then they zeroed in on the crime scene itself. There was a tremendous struggle apparent within the apartment, and this led officers to suspect that Olivia's attacker and murderer may in fact have been another female. And they based this on the fact of the disarray inside of the apartment and the belief that the individual responsible for this was obviously not exceedingly strong and was therefore unable to control Olivia as they had wanted to, which in turn led to the disarray inside of the apartment. This is how the next door neighbor to Olivia and a number of other women who live inside the complex come to be suspects for a period of time. They also looked at sex offenders who were in the department's files, individuals who had recently been released from prison for similar attacks, all of the normal tactics that police use as they start to broaden their horizons when looking for suspects of a violent crime. They're looking at every angle of this case, trying to determine who the best possible suspect might be. However, other than Olivia's exposed breast, there really was no evidence of a sexual motivation to this murder, which led the lead detectives on the case to think that it was more likely than not that Olivia had walked in on a burglary in progress and it had escalated from that point. The following morning, officers go back to the Ivy Home Apartments and begin re-canvassing the area. They learn that a number of individuals at the complex recalled having seen Michael there that day. They also learned that Michael was supposedly having an affair with a woman that lived inside of the apartment complex. This woman, whose name was Darlene, was known to have a number of different lovers. She is the one who some individuals stated constantly had men coming and going, many of whom would get lost and show up at wrong addresses. They also spoke to the paperboy, who stated that he had seen Olivia on that morning. He was aware of her as she got the Sunday paper from him, although they did not interact. He stated that Olivia was out walking her cat while he was delivering papers, that he had delivered the paper to the wrong address inside of her particular building and had actually gone back into the building to put it in the correct place before leaving again,
And officers fairly quickly scratched this young boy off of their list of suspects as they felt that he was forthright in the information that he was giving and was not attempting to deceive them. Now, while all of this is going on, this re-canvassing of the area, re-questioning of ear witnesses and eyewitnesses, other officers go to view Olivia's autopsy, which is not in fact conducted in Hampton, but is instead conducted in Norfolk. For those of you unfamiliar with the area, it's called the Tidewater area. You have Norfolk, Hampton, Portsmouth, a number of different communities which are all interconnected, mostly by the presence of the United States military, specifically the Navy, with Norfolk really being the hub and largest of these cities. So Olivia's body is transported to Norfolk, and her autopsy is fairly straightforward. It's found that there does not appear to have been any form of sexual assault beyond the exposing of one breast. There is blood on her face, her hair, her forearms, her one foot, and all over Olivia's fingernails. They note that one thumb and one forefinger have the nails broken. All of this is cataloged, and samples are taken from underneath and on top of her fingernails as well as on her arms. Remember, this is 1981. We are well before the advent of DNA testing as we know it today. So what they're going to be looking for is to, A, get Olivia's blood type, but also to see if there are traces of blood or skin on her body which came from another individual. On one of her fingernails, they found a curly dark hair which was placed into a bag for further examination. It was found that Olivia had suffered excessive blunt force trauma to her face as well as to her scalp from an object unknown. There were numerous contusions and lacerations present on the skin surface. In addition to this, the orbital bone on the left side of her face had been fractured, which in fact does explain a majority of the blood on Olivia's face, hands, and arms. If you've ever seen an individual who receives a fractured orbital bone, quite often there is a good deal of blood present as a result of this particular injury. In fact, you can search it out. There's a pro wrestling match. Again, everything comes back to pro wrestling at some point or another with this show, where a tag team called the Hardy Brothers are fighting a team called M&M. In a ladder match, one of the wrestlers who at that point wrestled under the name of Joey Mercury suffers a shattered orbital bone during the course of the match when a ladder hits him in the face. The amount of blood that comes from this wound is quite extraordinary, and having seen other similar accidents and injuries in the past has led me to know how delicate and how severe a fractured orbital bone can appear because of the amount of blood that is usually lost when this injury occurs. They also found
hemorrhaging to Olivia's brain, which is consistent with blunt force trauma injuries to the skull. Black eyes, a shattered nose, busted lip, a crushed mandible, which means that the movable part of her jaw had been struck with such force that it had shattered and quite literally pulverized from the force of the blow. There was also a reddish-brown ligature found wrapped around Olivia's neck that had pushed in on the skin of her throat 3 to 4 centimeters in depth. This caused hemorrhaging in the neck muscles along with breaking of blood vessels in the eyes. Now, to me, the severity of this assault and murder speaks more to a suspect that is there solely for the purpose of taking the victim's life. There may be other things inside this equation, such as a sexual motive, but just the severity of this assault really says to me that murder was the primary motive of this attack. We saw this with the Ted Bundy case, where he would strike his victims with such force that he would shatter their skulls. This is similar in nature to the ferocity that Bundy showed his victims. Olivia Christian was savaged. Now, there are some who may put forth the idea that the severity of the injuries inflicted upon her were solely an escalation of the encounter that Olivia had with her murderer, that this individual may have become more and more frustrated as the attack became prolonged and the perpetrator became concerned that they were going to be discovered. But I put forth another case that we covered, and that is the murder of Frank Carlson and the savage rape of his wife, Annette, by Angelo Pavaju, who we were able here at the Deathcast to help keep incarcerated. Pavaju severely savaged and assaulted Annette to the point that it was overkill, breaking furniture over her back, trying to set her on fire, strangling her. An exceedingly horrific rape still is in the annals of the Deathcast, the single most brutal and savage crime that I have ever covered. The level of savagery perpetrated on Annette and her late husband is similar in scope to the savagery that was perpetrated against Olivia Christian. The only real difference being that this individual was not able to carry out a sexual assault. And my personal opinion is that is because Olivia fought back so valiantly against. There was also a good amount of defensive wounds found on Olivia's body, mostly in the forearm and hand regions of her body, which paints a picture of a woman frantically fighting back against the individual who's attempting to take her life and warding off the blows of the instrument of death that he is wielding. As is standard practice during an autopsy, they had to examine Olivia's pelvic region to see if she had been, in fact, sexually assaulted. Olivia died a virgin, so the son of a bitch that committed this horrific crime was not able to take that last piece of dignity from her. And Olivia's death was ruled as blunt force trauma and ligature strangulation, both of which caused her demise. We're going to end the episode at this point. I hope that you have enjoyed our first look into the murder of Olivia Christensen. Until next time, stay morbid.